hello. I hope you've all burned your Christmas cards and thrown your tree into the canal because Christmas is over and it's bad luck to keep that stuff in the house. Welcome to the first Big Mouth of 2019. I'm Andrew Harrison, and with me is Sean Pattenden, the Greg's Vegan Sausage Roll to my genetically modified supersized pig in a blanket. Hello, Sean. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Andrew Harrison.
Is it too late to be saying Happy New Year to people?
No, I think we've got to the 15th, haven't we?
Have we? Is that EU law?
Yeah, Ides of January, I'd say.
The Ides of January, yeah. You just made that up, didn't you?
I have.
So listeners may well have seen you, Sean Pattenden, in BBC 4's Story of 1987 over Christmas, which was a nice surprise.
Oh, yes.
How was that
Better
experience?
Than being a horrible surprise. Thanks for that.
Was that a new one that they just done for this?
Yeah, we recorded it in December. Yeah, so and it went out very quickly. Yeah, after that, it's a new one, brand new.
Mm, there you go. Yeah. Why 1987 at the end of 2018?
Because last year they did 1986 in January,
Andrew.
It doesn't
make any sense.
Well, it does in the world of pop.
It's not your fault, but I thought it was quite the Wikipedia version of 1987. Everybody's rich and everybody's got a Philo fax and everybody's got red stripe braces.
So what's
everybody's
your
going
version?
For it. Probably being a poor student and hey, the minor strike, yeah.
There is a Jesus and Mary Chain side, there's a Smith side, there's a Cure side that were all in the charts then, but they didn't really want to go on about that. They wanted to do the glossy, shiny version, but that's all right.
Well, it did remind me that most of the music of 1987 was completely dreadful and house music couldn't turn up quick enough.
Oh, it was bubbling away.
It was bubbling away. We're going to be talking about Bros in some detail in a bit. Yay. That brings us to our two guests. Both of them rave veterans of good standing. Ralph Moore is a contributor editor at Mixmag, the Hansard of house music. He's managed loads of DJs and artists, including Tentsnake and Eric Murillo. Hello, Ralph. Welcome back to Big Mouth.
It's good to be back.
Apart from the Bros documentary, what was your highlight of Christmas?
That was my highlight of Christmas. It was everyone's highlight of Christmas.
Well, we'll be doing that in some detail. Like I say, any runners-up?
I went to a great party on New Year's Day. I actually stayed in on New Year's Eve, which is very, very unusual for me. New Year's Day, I went to Leeds.
Yes.
Leeds with five E's, obviously, in
the hashtag. There used to be a T-shirt when I was a student in Leeds at the height of Acid House, and it said LSD and two E's, Leeds.
Well, Leeds is still a great city to rave in. I was at a place called Canal Mills, which is about to close. Mm. So they did one final party, and it was Paul Wolford, Gerd Janssen, PBR Street Gang, and... Yeah, it was great. Leeds is a great place to visit for 24 hours once a year.
24 hours? I think they should put that on the road signs. Leeds, a great place for raving.
Once a year.
Once a year. Or as many times a year as you like, actually. Did you see that 1997 thing?
Of course I did.
Mm. You always see... documentaries about 1975 and they say, and the country was desperate for punk rock. The country is, look, here's a picture of Mrs. Thatcher taking milk away from children. The country's desperate for punk rock. But you never see 1987 and they say, the country was desperate for raving because here's Ben Volpellier Piero in his hat. Do they?
The thing is, it was my first year at secondary school. So watching that was absolutely incredible for me. Because all of that stuff was the stuff, it ties in with my memories of Neighbours and Kylie and Jason.
Yeah.
So I loved pop music. Obviously, like you, I was delighted when, Pump Up the Volume came along. But I actually have no issues with half of those records at all. I had a big smile on my face when it finished, to be honest. I thought it was great.
You big appeaser.
Also joining us today is journalist, sometime Balearic DJ, and now men's style commentator, Anthony Teasdale. He's murmuring in the background. The man who can tell you which variant of the Adidas trim trab was in on terraces across the north of England in March 1985, and other important facts. Hello, Tony T. Welcome back, and Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year.
Did you have a good one?
Yeah, it was great. It was my M62 Christmas.
can you elaborate on that?
So, started off in my area, just north of Liverpool, and had fun there, went for a pretentious meal with my mum and my wife, then went over to Manchester, where the in-laws are, and then, like Ralph here, I went to Leeds as well.
Oh. Going to Leeds is the thing to do in 2019.
It's the thing, yeah. So I went over to Leeds as well. Now, I didn't do any raving, but I certainly did some aimless wandering about and saw sort of... ghosts of old rave Leeds past.
I saw one of those. It was Dave Beer from Back to Basics.
Yes. To be fair to Dave Beer, he looked like a ghost of rave past in 1988, didn't he, really? He's certainly been living the
He's
role.
He's still there.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
it was great. I mean, I despise this time of year, but because I don't like, because I have that sort of like, I won't say I have that sad disorder, but I have that sort of aversion to getting dark at 3:30.
Guessing a bit of a highlight might have been Liverpool top of the league.
Yeah, that's good, but now I can't sleep
because
it's the you know, as they say, it's the hope I can't stand. So
Yeah,
that's really strange. And when the dream dies, which it eventually will, I'll be crestfallen.
Right, I'm contractually obliged to ask: did you see 1987 Top of the Pops?
No, but I do need to talk about this.
Go on.
Right.
I think that was 87 is when things started getting better again in the 80s. There is this chunk of the mid-80s, which is mostly terrible, between 84 and about 86. And it's the fashion is quite good because there's lots of people wearing Puma California, semi-flares, hush puppies, and tweed jackets. Yeah, so I all that.
And deerstalker hats.
And deerstalker hats. And Damon Grant of Brookside Mullets.
Of course.
But by 87, things have gone very sort of 50s looking. If you look at Rick Astley, it very much the time, which is chinos, big, baggy, best company tops. Everyone had quiffs.
Yeah, that's post Levi's 501 stuff. Post Nick Kamen.
We all wanted to look a bit like that. So I didn't watch the film, but I do look back on it with fondness. It was when I think house started to appear. Not acid house, the culture, but house as in there is this trendy
house
music.
House as in trapped by Colonel Abrams.
Yes.
That kind of house. That,
what I would call Hitman and Her House.
Oh, okay.
You would see. So. In the warehouse in Chicago at the same time, there's lots of people jacking. For me, there are people in suits dancing to Love Can't Turn Around.
And that was the last time you could dance to house music and still tuck your shirt into your trousers. After that, shirts came out of trousers in a big way. Well, it was a major turning point, Sean.
If you look at Shoom, and the early pictures of Shoom being the venerable first acid house club, people aren't wearing what we consider the rave uniform. They're actually wearing surf gear, Levi's 501s, DMs, and fact fans, waistcoats.
Waistcoats.
Waistcoats were in. Waistcoats.
The style they tried to hide.
Waistcoats were in, weren't they?
They very much were. I can feel a spin-off podcast coming on. Sean, move us along.
2019 is supposed to be the year that Brexit happens. Subs, please check. So in your capacity as terror star guru, what will everyone be wearing once we're back in 80s style poverty?
Well, I mean, if it's proper 80s style poverty, I hope to see the return of National Coal Board donkey jackets.
Oh, nice, yeah.
The KLF wore them. With KLF printed on the floor a bit.
But so far, what I'm seeing is one, these enormous ugly trainers, which have been around for probably about a year or so now. I don't know if you've noticed them. They look like hovercraft.
I don't look at
like
trainers,
the big
I'm 50.
Trainers.
They're just, Balenciaga do them. Mm. And also, this, which I am annoyed about because I wanted to do it myself, the return of the Burberry scarf. Burberry is everywhere at the moment. Have you seen this? Mm.
I did know that there was a point at which Earl Brutus were going to record a song called Burberry Burka, and then it never came to fruition. But that's good then.
I'm seeing Brookside Chic though coming back.
Oh, go on.
Bit of Barry Grant, you know, that kind of thing. Bit of Terry. Don't you reckon?
Well, Barry was like king of the scowls, wasn't he? He was called Paul Usher. And he was a big face at Liverpool matches, wasn't he? He would go to Liverpool and he'd wear what they call lots of Tom.
Oh, God. Around,
a bit of tomfoolery around the neck.
Oh, okay.
And he was like kings of the scowls, I think, Barry Grant.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll see. Right, we have a slightly more retro edition of Big Mouth this week, talking about Brookside. That Bross documentary, surely you've all seen it. Probably about a million times. Contemporary Spinal Tap, agonising accidental self-satire, poignant masterpiece, or have the Goss brothers actually faked us out by knowingly creating something that's got everyone talking about Bross for the first time in 30 years. Plus, the fall again of HMV. What's worse, journalists scoffing at the demise of mainstream record shops, man, that don't sell artisan tote bags, or us for bemoaning the disappearance of physical retail that we don't actually use. And in sobering news for rave dads, it's 30 years since New Order's fluorescent classic technique. I'm sure that Anthony, Ralph and Andrew will have nothing to say about that. All these things after a quick message from Andrew.
New year, new you, and the best way to like the way you look and look the way you like is to back Big Mouth on Patreon, the crowdfunding platform. Why not take that fiver a month that you'd otherwise spend in the pub and pledge it to us to help us cover our studio costs and provide you with an entertaining show every week. You'll get an extra bit of the show every week too. This time, we're going to be confessing to the critically derided genres of music that we secretly love. And of course, you'll get our undying gratitude as well. Just search Patreon Big Mouth or go to the Big Mouth Facebook page to find out more. All we are saying is buy us a pint.
Conkers, need I say more? Bubbles, the genesis of a new beginning. We all know what we're talking about. On to what I consider my personal Christmas present, the BBC's showing of When the Screaming Stops, the documentary about Bros twins Matt and Luke Goss. Maybe you're one of the three people in the country who didn't watch it. Maybe, like some of us, you've had it on repeat since Christmas Eve and can recite parts of the programme backwards. A cross between This Is Spinal Tap, Alan Partridge and the Smash Hits Poll Winners Party, it's brought the hashtag tingly balls back into common usage. Let's remind ourselves of some of Matt's pearls of wisdom.
I think the letters H-O-M-E are so important because they personify the word home.
Chess, love a bit of chess. Got the... have a few glasses of scotch. Long game of chess. Love it. Here is the little kind of conversational corner. I've said timber on quite a few trees now with that blunt butter knife, and I can assure you it's quickly turning into a very, very efficient tool. I made a conscious decision because of Stevie Wonder to not be superstitious.
Bros there, having an argument or doing a song. Who can tell? A Teutonic Cain and Abel, sort of. They live to torture each other, like the veritable Greek narrative that is. This programme contains fame, fortune, hubris, sibling rivalry, an epic journey, naivety, conversation corner and darts. But only one darts and no dartboard. It's now my favourite film. Ralph, you don't come across as a massive Bros fan, but what did you make of this?
The film was wonderful. I watched it again last night. It is everything that you've talked about. The thing is, I wasn't buying the music, but the phenomenon was there. They were the pop band before New Kids on the Block, basically, that Britain took to its heart. The reality is, no one, especially not music pop pickers, wakes up thinking they're going to put on either Bros or New Kids on the Block anymore. It's something that sort of lives in your childhood. So the reality is no one's really been thinking about Bros for a very, very, very long time. So the fact that they've now come back means that unless you are one of those girls who are waiting for Matt to come through the airport lounge, your brain is literally going, all right, so that's what they look like now.
So what were you expecting?
Matt Goss was doing very well in Vegas. And of course that, regardless of how ridiculous or stupid the whole thing is, the David Brent jokes that are about, you know, everything from the road sweeper to Conkers doesn't take in, you know, both of them have technically done quite well. Neither of them are, you know, have gone back to working in a supermarket. Mm-hmm. Luke has actually been in a couple of films that I liked. Yes, his new film looks terrible, but he lives in LA. He's doing stuff. He's, you know, he's all right. And Matt clearly is doing insanely well. The fact that the house is incredibly daft, and that, you know, the bulldog and the bulldog and the pint,
yes,
he obviously is not self-aware at all, so that's the most fun bit of this whole thing, is that they're not Matt particularly self-aware. Like most people, I imagine you warm more to Luke than to Matt. That's kind of the, if you know some people have come out and said, oh, they're both idiots and da-da-da-da. I don't know whether I agree with that. Matt is a bit daft. You kind of, in the end, can only feel a little bit of, you feel a little bit sorry for them. And you kind of, in the end, can only hope that perhaps, you know, there is another Bros show at the O2. Like, why not? Yeah. Like, let people enjoy it.
Anthony, was it what you expected?
I don't know what I expected. But I think I'd agree with Ralph. I think there's been a lot of, you know, amusing jokes about what happened in the documentary, but in the end they're the ones who are living in fantastic splendour in sunny Los Angeles, and you know, people like me who live in small flats in London are laughing at them. So I mean, you know, who's winning really? I thought what was most interesting about it was their relationship and the obvious insecurity Luke has.
It's parade of like, I really like proper rock music t-shirts is like kind of, it's funny and it's kind of heartbreaking as well. Look, I've got a, you know, I've got Soundgarden t-shirts. I want to play my drums.
It's very much, it's not just a relationship between two twins. It's a relationship between a drummer and a singer.
Oh, really? Yeah. So elaborate on that.
Because I think drummers are often looked down upon. And they don't get often get publishing rights, which leads to the spectacle after two albums of them thinking, hang on a minute, the singer's loaded and I'm skinned.
They didn't like the songs, though.
No. Mm-hmm. But there is that thing about that. And obviously, Matt is the star. And there was, you know, I think at one stage Luke talks about his brother being more handsome than him, singer. So Matt is the star and Luke is sort of secondary to it, but I thought he was a nice guy but still hasn't come to terms with the fact that his brother is this and he is that, and a lot of that anger and resentment came out. I felt sorry for him a little bit. You know, I think obviously lots about it are funny, but I think once you go past that, there's a slight tragic element to the whole thing.
Yes, that's the great tragedy part, isn't it? Andrew Harrison, lack of Ken.
I thought it was the epitome of big tragedy, actually. Yeah, lack of Ken. Where's Ken? He's Ken? Mentioned Craig Logan. He's mentioned once.
Mm-hmm. And there's a small picture of him. It sort of recedes into the background.
Yeah. And, of course, in many respects, he is the most prosperous of the lot because he went on to... Wasn't he head of A&R at EMI for years?
I think so. He's got songwriting credits, hasn't he?
He's on the DVD, no?
He's on the DVD of the extras. So I have seen his interview, which is incredibly diplomatic about the Goss brothers. Yes.
But that's probably why Ken got to where he is. And,
he probably is.
You know, powers of diplomacy. It's surprising how few people know where Ken came from, the name Ken. It came from Viz, didn't it?
That's right.
They had a free Viz mug, which had cut out on the back page. And it said Matt, Luke in huge stars, and then a little tiny star with Ken next to it. And a disclaimer saying, warning, free Bros mug not to be used with liquids, which I thought was particularly good.
And everyone took Ken up after that point. He wasn't called Craig Logan anymore.
He was never called Craig ever again. I enjoyed the film. I came to it a bit late, actually, because I saw everybody was banging on about it. I wasn't aware it had been on, so I didn't watch it until...
It was a bit of a Twitter sensation, I would have to say.
Yeah. And actually, I was surprised at how poignant it was and how it wasn't entirely, pure Spinal Tap, let's laugh at these pop idiots. I think Bros's music is objectively dreadful. They were a bloody awful group. But there's worse things than that.
But there's not much music in the documentary, which I was wondering whether that was licensing issues or they just decided not to put it in because it didn't really matter.
Probably the former. Yeah. But there are worse things than making terrible records. Many of my favourite people make terrible records. I found them to be... I found it's all about Matt's total lack of self-awareness. Luke is cursed with a bit of self-awareness, and in that environment, it's the worst possible thing. Mm. And his kind of desperate need to sort of be significant, and the fact that his drumming is so... There's no straight up four on the floor, is there, with Luke? It's got to be Phil's. Mm. I'm here. I exist. Listen to me, Phil's. But I thought the way that the film skirted over the death of their sister in a car crash, and then they have to go on Wogan, and that's dealt with very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And the death of their mother before they get back together again. Mm. There's clearly, I mean, I hate to be California about it, but there's a lot of hurt going on here. And I'm not sure
it's fully explored. A lot of unresolved issues, yes.
I strongly suspect that we've been slightly baited and switched on this one because it's produced by their own management company. And I think that they're fully aware that the only way to get Bros talked about is to do something that is comical, which this is, because the comeback wasn't a massive success. As Ralph accurately says, nobody's going to play the music again unless they were
I would say the O2 date sold out in 7 seconds, apparently, according to the directors of this film.
Yeah.
To be fair, it did.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a success. It's just they didn't do the tour, did they?
There are a lot of Brossettes around. But is that going to translate into an ongoing career? Who knows?
What I want to know, Anthony or Ralph, the issue of whether the machine chewed them up and spat them out again, I don't think that we got anywhere near that. Do you have view on
what
that?
Do you mean by
Tom
way?
Watkins isn't mentioned at all.
The idea
of the money that them spending it is only glossed over. What do you think?
The intricacies of music management in the end probably aren't going to get you the headlines. That's for the likes of us. We find that sort of thing interesting. But I always think they're not digging up the road, are they? And even if it didn't go that well, even if they did, you know, lose money, they're still living in California.
Yes, they are living in California.
And I keep going back to this. You know, it's like when you have these people who are on the X Factor and they go, oh, well, you know, they only came fourth and now they're playing on cruise ships. Cruise ships is significantly better than working in a chicken factory.
Yeah, although I'm not sure everybody sets their sights as kind of, you know. Like, you know.
Do you see what I mean?
You are you saying, Tony, that the man who's sweeping the streets is a king to you? Is that what you're saying? He's a king.
He's a king to me.
He's a king to me, yeah.
It's a very important one. I'm just going to jump in quick because, Andrew, I remember mentioning that to you before last time I was here, that an awful lot of 80s synth pop acts have no choice but to go and do that, whether that is the Human League or good old Carol Decker or ABC. Mm. They do the ships.
Mm.
And it's fine to do the ships if you're, what's that lady on Channel 5?
Jane McDonald.
Jane McDonald. It's fine if you're her, but if you have an element of... I was once Terence Trent D'Arcy. Like, Terence Trent will get...
He doesn't do the ships.
He doesn't do the ships.
No.
But, you know, a lot of those people do the ships.
Well, there's the dignity of labour. You know, there's no shame in working where you need to work to keep yourself going. And I take my rakish side on Matt Goss hat off to them for continuing to work. But I do feel that we were slightly baited and switched on this one. Well, I think it's just constructed to make you talk about Bros again. And again, there's nothing wrong with that
worked,
either.
Yes. It's worked,
actually, the most important question before we move on is,
how
did they get to that point? How does Matt Goss become the David Brent, Frank Sinatra of now?
Natural, organic, manscaping,
see,
probably.
If I was in any way involved in managing this band, I would be going for the open-ended reality show. I would be Osbournes-ing the Goss Brothers. With a camera on Matt at all times, because it's an ITV2 smash waiting to be made, isn't it? Life with the Gosses.
It is. I think you're right.
Actually, yes, it is, isn't it? Anyway, Kim Kardashian is probably ringing them right
absolutely,
now. Get on the telly.
Keeping up with the Gosses. Mm. Anyway, that's enough flat top haircuts and pod shoes with Grosch bottle tops in the laces. Let's get bang up to date with a choice of music from one of our guests, Anthony Teasdale. What have you brought in to delight the listeners?
It's Beulah Loves Dancing by Planning to Rock.
Yeah.
What a great record this is.
Who are they?
I've no idea.
Okay. And it's Beulah as in the girl's name, not as in like anyone, Beulah.
Yeah, it's from what I can tell that she's either from Manchester or Leeds, and it is a Jack in House track, as I believe the kids would describe it these days, with this girl talking about how much her sister used to play house music in the house that she had with her mum and dad. Spoken word stuff sometimes is a little bit earnest, but this is great and it's fun and it's really dancey and it's one of those things that can be underground and then become a monster smash.
Well, let's have a listen. This is Beulah Loves Dancing by Planning to Rock.
She loved house music and listening to stations in Manchester would make her own house mixtapes from the radio and would listen to them obsessively. When she could make her own cassettes and play them over and over, she would dance endlessly in her bedroom.
Shaping up to be a ravey old episode. What a catastrophe all around. Anyway, moving on. One of the more dismal events over Christmas was the collapse into administration for the second time of HMV, the venerable 97-year-old high street retailer in the middle of a disastrous holiday sales period. This was the second time HMV had gone bust, but unlike in 2013, the collapse provoked not widespread indifference and the HMV Twitter feed going rogue, but a wave of nostalgia, la recherche de bargain bins perdu. And the reason might have been a snidey Guardian story saying that we wouldn't miss it at all because it was for beginners in music and not real music fans. And also it didn't sell tote bags by local artists. What did HMV mean to us, and will we miss it if it can't be rescued? To remind us that HMV is still relevant, here's an actual UK number one from last year that gives a shout out to the House of Nipper. This is grime person and show favourite Dave with Funky Friday.
Telepen girl, you can HMU. I don't want to cuddle in HUG. And I'm still shopping in HMV for all of my niggas in HMP. Heard you got a girl going DMU. If I DM'd you, would she DM me? Young black brother, I'm a stylish G. Man, I put the IC in IC3. They tell me I'm gifted and rep. Nothing was nice just to live in a trap. Now if I go ask that chick for a snap, I could bet money she's...
I'm still shopping in HMV for all my... in HMP. Exemplary rhymes there from Dave. Now, can we in good conscience moan about HMV going? What's the last thing you bought from it, Tony?
The last thing I did in HMV was take a picture of one of my 12 inches on Soma Records in there, and I send it to my mum. I haven't bought anything there in years, probably about 10 years. Mm. So as is the way with these things, and I'd include high streets in this, is that, you know, if you don't use them, you do lose them.
Yeah.
But I think it's sad to an extent, because firstly, people have lost their jobs, and that's rubbish, and losing your job is a terrible thing. And it is also, I think, for people of our age, it's where we got their music. I mean, for me, HMV was always much better than Virgin Megastore. I used to go,
wow,
why?
Fight and talk.
Yeah. They knew more. Really? It was a better set. It was a better customer experience. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Yeah. I remember going to HMV in Manchester on my 10th birthday, and they had this shop in the Arndale Centre. It was incredibly exotic. Mm. And I was really into Adam Ant when I was 10. And I saw my first thing I'd ever seen, an import record. Mm. So it looked like a normal record, but it had Japanese writing on it. From then, I was always into it. And I used to go to the one in Birmingham when I was at uni there. Incredibly knowledgeable and passionate staff. Yeah. And unlike other dance music record shops, they didn't save all the best records for their mates.
Yes, they were not kind of like, this is only for the DJs, were they? I mean, I used to spend a lot of time in the HMV in Leeds, and then the one in... I basically worked upstairs from the one in Oxford Street and would go down in lunch hour and waste all my money there. Mm. And the dance section at its height was a huge wall of 12 inches with handwritten recommendations from people who really, really knew their stuff. And when you accidentally ended up in the jazz section or the classical section, that was the same as well. So this kind of calumny that, they didn't have knowledgeable staff and it was only there for beginners. Well, everybody's a beginner at some point, aren't they? Everybody needs a bit of guidance. How about you, Ralph? Are you an HMV habitué?
I think we already know the answer to that already. As a teenager, it would be the reason to come up to London from Sussex would be to go to HMV, Virgin and occasionally Tower.
Yeah.
Because it was better than the choice. It was basically like going into a library, you know, and whether that was to browse or, you know, from my perspective, obviously to buy dance 12 inches, you know, dance 12 inch imports as well, which were cheaper there than anywhere else. You would be able to get them, and you know that they would stock them. And like you say, they were, you know, I remember seeing the little notes, Masters at Work, double packs, you know, Daft Punk, 12-inch singles, imports, like all of that stuff. That's where you would go and get them. I mean, I know what you mean when you say that it was better than Virgin. There wasn't, in terms of stock and what you could get, it wasn't really about that for me. It was about if one was £1 or £2 cheaper, which you might occasionally find. You might get like a £9.99 special in one shop. But basically, they were the same experience in terms of what they stocked.
I'd agree. I thought what Andrew's talking about is they seem to set things out really well in HMV. It was, you're saying about the wall of 12 inches. It,
I think 100%. I mean, the one on Oxford Street was, you know, when I first worked at Mixmag, it was literally around the corner. So I guess for a lot of people in this room and beyond, what it really represented was in the world before streaming or downloads, the day Jay-Z's album came out, the day Madonna's album came out, you went and bought it. Radiohead's album came out. You remember, and I'm sure everyone will remember that experience.
I remember seeing Morrissey in the Bond Street HMV moving his own single to the front of the pile on the day it came out. So it wasn't just the punters, you know. And also, I mean, we've all worked for magazines that were headquartered, EMAP magazines that were headquartered above the HMV on Oxford Street. So you could literally look out the window and see the audience and see the queue around the block when the Oasis album came out.
We also do have to say, if anyone doesn't know, it is now a big Sports Direct and has been since 2019.
And I think that's worse than knocking down the Acropolis. I just think it's such a shame. It's like, and the way that the Virgin Megastore is now Primark, it's like, in no other area of our shared culture would the kind of temples be allowed to be desecrated like this, you know. Mm. But, you know, that's retail. You know, we didn't use it. Also, are we slightly starry-eyed here in that in its later years, as it got filled up with games and Funko bobbly pop head things and T-shirts and keyrings and Bob Marley mugs, and it's harder and harder to actually find the records.
Yeah.
Are we sort of, you know, being kind of starry-eyed and thinking of a time that had gone, actually? Mm. And that wasn't the HMV that was still there.
Well, Ante, you hit the nail on the head slightly before. Andrew, when was the last time you bought a piece of music from an HMV?
I actually bought the David Bowie 5 Years box set from HMV, but I bought it from HMV.com. So, and I actually bought it originally because I wanted to buy it from I wanted to buy it from someone that wasn't Amazon, actually.
Yeah.
I wanted to buy it from someone who's paying their taxes. I'm going to spend 90 quid on something. I actually want the VAT to get paid. But yeah, I bought it from the website. I mean, I suppose the thing that's missing from all of this is people go, well, it's just the streaming has destroyed it. You know, in other areas of retail, the experience of shopping has been preserved. You know, Starbucks basically reinvented the cafe and made the cafe a place you wanted to go again. When you see things like these, kind of, you know, the flagship stores that are everywhere, the Nespresso shop that sells nothing but, you know, little plastic coffee things, what they're really selling is the experience of that thing. And HMV, when it kind of got pile it high, sell it cheap, lost the experience of spending time, as you say, Ralph, like a library, spending time in the world of music.
Because I think much of Rough Trade East, what they do in the Rough Trade lot, nicked that stuff from HMV, which is listening pods, which they didn't have before HMV did it, and in stores. But in stores make them more performances, make them gigs, that sort of thing that HMV just was too slow to retain.
But actually,
something happened where it did
HMV
lose that.
HMV was brilliant on gigs. They put gigs on
all
the time.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, but it seemed to lose that, didn't it? And it was, you can buy a USB stick, but
I've got to be honest. I find the Rough Trades and the kind of, you know, boutique thing. You know, look, I mean, I get records for free. I get music for free. It's pretty much the only perk of this job. But I do like to buy it as well. Mm. And I actually find the Rough Trades slightly intimidating. Also, the range of music they sell, you can't go in there and buy the latest, you know, clunky techno thing alongside a pop hit.
And that jazz bit of HMV in Oxford Street was amazing. It was just like a pod because it was sealed so that the music didn't clash with the music from the classical department. You could just go and sort of just be in that bit. Mm. Also, HMV, really good place to meet a friend. You can't meet a friend in Rough Trade, can you? Because you're going to be sort of snobby and cool. But, you know, you can just hang around. You know, there's a sort of social element that I quite like, the big change of safe in them.
So if Big Mouth got a fantastic consultancy gig to save HMV, what would we do? How would we save HMV? Obviously, loads of comfy chairs for a kick-off.
Well, I think we'd have to get much smaller premises
for
a start. Let's be realistic.
Mm. And the question is, as well as HMV, is also FOP.
Yeah.
Which is obviously smaller. Mm. And I go to FOP every week. Do I shop in HMV every week? No. But I go to FOP every single week and get something in there. And I also feel that is... I've definitely met girls for dates and spent an hour there beforehand and hung out in a way that I definitely don't do about HMV anymore. Mm. But you've kind of hit the nail on the head. Apart from the content, what's killing it is the rent.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, the retail experience in this country reflects what people want. It's a really good barometer. It's a much better barometer of opinion than actually what people say they'll do.
We're getting quite Mary Portas here, aren't we?
So, yeah. If it was me, much smaller premises, that would save us a few bob. And I would say that maybe you go for, I think Ray, was it Ray's Jazz? Used to have a bookshop downstairs. So maybe you combine, part of it is HMV, part of it is a really nice bookshop. Mm. Part of it is an organic cafe and a whole field of foods on the top. Because I think the sort of people who will spend £20 on a double thick vinyl are also the sort of people who'll buy fancy coffee and a nice single edition. It's that curated
thing.
You're
basically vegan sausage rolling it, aren't you?
I'm vegan sausage
rolling. Get a vegan sausage roll.
I do have a bee in my bonnet that I do want to talk about on this.
Make it quick.
It is the attitude of apparently left-wing journalists talking and the way they write about the loss of jobs in industries that they do not approve of. And I think there's a real double standard here. And you'll get this in The Guardian, which is HMV is closing, i.e. the stuff about the staff. You got it when certain men's mags closing. And I'm always sad when anyone loses their jobs. And it's so different to the if someone's saying a steelworks lose the job. To me, when anyone loses the job, it's a terrible thing.
I actually did see some people saying, well, it's great that HMV is going to go because all that plastic is such a waste and so bad for the planet. Like, you joyless bore. You joyless, joyless bore. We've got to make things out of something. Do you want to have no music? And then, of course, the snappy rejoinder comes in. Well, those server farms that deliver your Spotify, they run quite hot, you know.
Yes.
They're boiling the oceans as well. So I just wonder whether, books are every bit as exposed to online retailers music is. Waterstones has been a success. Waterstones is a great place to go. Daunt, the Daunt books kind of reverse takeover of Waterstones, where their ethos went into a big retail experience, has worked. Why can't that work with the HMV? I don't know. I think it's smaller premises, but then where are we going to put the big comfy seats? That's what I want to know. It's a difficult
cafe
one.
Bit upstairs.
Well, what's the most intimidating record shop you've ever been in?
Oh, God, loads. I mean, if various ones in Birmingham in the 90s when I used to work there, and you would walk in and you just think, they're not going to, they don't, there's obviously lots of sort of like gentlemen of a certain type who don't do a great deal during the day, but do seem to drive very nice cars. But also, of course, the most intimidating of all was Eastern Bloc in Manchester.
I was just about to say.
Can I just say,
that is my most intimidating.
Am I allowed to swear or not?
You can, it's a podcast.
Yeah. If you're not a mate, fuck off, was one of their ads.
Well, that's great. That's welcoming. Sean, is Eastern Bloc your choice as well?
Absolutely my choice. You just can't go in there without freezing and then wanting to run out again.
Mine was Probe in Liverpool, which had steep, intimidating steps at the top of which was Pete Byrne scowling at you, and people would always be sat outside trying to get up the courage to go in. I went past it the other day. It's now a Smoky Moe's barbecue or something, which is another crime. Ralph, what's the most intimidating record shop you ever went in?
Well, I would say that when I first started coming to London, you know, as a teenager, the reason that you went to HMV or Virgin, certainly to buy import dance 12s, was to avoid all of those shops in Soho, which as a teenage boy were extremely daunting, because you walked in and you knew that you were young and impressionable, and it wasn't just that you felt like they were staring at you, it was that you shouldn't be there unless you're spending money, and if you didn't know what you were buying, they're going to jump on you. Oh, he's buying that.
They could break you, those shops.
I hope HMV is rescued for that, if only for that reason. They don't judge you. They never judged you. All right, then, let's have a bit more contemporary music purchased digitally and not in a record shop, because we are massive hypocrites. Ralph Moore, what have you brought in for us?
I brought in Mary Davidson's album. Ironically, it's called Working Class Woman. Mm-hmm. But Ninja Tune, as a label, have gone... In the 20 years that I've been sort of a journalist, they've gone from being the world of Cold Cut and the world of Timber and, you know, DJ Vadim, to now, all of a sudden, they're a powerhouse. Mm. Not only are they putting out lots of interesting sort of American West Coast hip-hop, and they're also putting out stuff like this, which is she's a Canadian vocalist, producer, artist. If you remember the Felix the House Cat album Kittens in the Glitz, which had Miss Kitten on it, it has that sort of detached sense of irony and humour. And
is it just French voices sounding bored? Which is one of my favourite kinds of music.
I mean, the big track is called Work It, and the premise of the track is that to do well, you have to work hard. And so everyone has jumped on this in the media when they've... The music is also great, but it's, you know, it's like, to be a winner, you got to work it. And that is very, very true. I think what she's saying is all these people who pretend that everything falls out of the sky very easily, it doesn't. The album is great. I've listened to it pretty much more than anything. Daniel Avery has remixed the next single, which is called Lara. And that's what we're playing, I think.
This is the unremixed version of Lara. This is Marie Davidson with Lara. Finally, it's January, which means there's nothing coming out. So we can continue with our occasional series, Weren't Things Great 30 Years Ago? Supposedly recorded in sunblasted Ibiza, although we're going to hear more about that in a minute, New Order's Technique was released in the frosty winter of January 1989. Heralded by Fine Time, possibly the most inexplicable New Order single ever, which matched their idea of acid house with Barney pretending to be Barry White, it is widely considered to be the best example of the New Order sound. What is it? What's so great about it? And will our two veteran raver guests have anything bad at all to say about it? First up, here's my favourite track from Technique. This is Mr. Disco. Find you. technique. Ralph Moore, is this the best New Order album?
It's the one that journalists always want to talk about. And when I interviewed Stephen Morris, it was the one that he wanted to talk about. And he talks about the fact that it was a very debauched time and that they spent the days... They basically spent their nights at Amnesia in the days waking up around 12 and getting a bit of work done. But essentially, as someone who's also spent 20 years in Ibiza now, I know what that experience was like for me, and it was wonderful. And for them, for it to be a job and to make an album around raving, it kind of is the joy of the record. Like, it, you know, that feeling does sort of seep into it in a way that you don't sort of necessarily get so much with other New Order albums. I mean, the folklore is all about Ibiza on this record.
Although I loved it without really knowing what a mess the entire recording process was, because everybody goes, yes, recorded in Ibiza. They got literally got some drums done and that was about it. And had to finish it all at Real World Peter Gabriel Studio, didn't they, in slightly less ravey Gloucestershire, somewhere like that, rainy and kind of, you know, woody. And yet it still has that ultra fluorescent, ultra sunshine, even though half the tracks sound like The Cure.
But you could also argue as well, beyond the music, that it's the most iconic artwork of a New Order album, I think.
That beautiful statue with a kind of heart, you know, it's cross-processed, multi-coloured, really intense colour.
I think if you closed your eyes and had to think of a New Order sleeve, that's the one I would think of too. Rather, and in the same way with The Cure, you'd think of Disintegration, I think.
Yeah. What did you make of Fine Time when it turned up? Because it was there's no conventional song structure. It's them trying to do Acid House and getting it really wrong in a really good way.
It's definitely not in my top 10 favourite New Order tracks. Let's put it that way. I actually think my favourite New Order track is Regret.
All right.
It's definitely top three. But yeah, Fine Time, I obviously have it, but I don't think I've ever put it on.
Not even the Steve Silk Hurley mixes, which House It Up good style. Ralph staring into the distance.
No.
Tony T, what was the technique in your record box?
Yeah. Well, it was actually the first CD I ever bought.
Really?
Yes.
Do you think I better trade up now into CDs?
I'm straight away. I do still listen to it, and it's the perfect album for working to. So if you're at home this afternoon when you're listening, stick it on. If you've got a deadline to get to, it's that. And I think the reason I like it is because I think it sounds like a mixtape. It's like it doesn't feel like the song's not that individual. They all are basically house bangers. So
I don't know about that though. Half of them do sound like The Cure. Half of them are guitars and drums.
To me, I think it's rave banging all the way through, and they sort of flow into one. I don't think it's that individual, but I think it's a fantastic whole in itself. It's something I'm still listening to now.
Balearic Adjudicator, is this a Balearic record?
No.
Okay, yeah, actually, there's too much going on, isn't there?
There's too much going on. Also, Balearic is a singles genre to me. And it's the best Balearic stuff is made by the naffiest artist. The whole point of Balearic is that someone who's truly awful or not particularly fantastic, i.e. Tadja Seville.
Oh, I'm not. I'm not having that. She's great.
I'm not.
Love is contagious.
Yeah. No.
Get out of my studio.
What I'm saying is, Love Is Contagious is the track.
Everything else is rubbish.
Well, I wouldn't even know. Okay. But what I'm saying is, so no, I don't think it's Balearic, but I do think it's a really significant. And what I like about it, and you talk about Stephen Morris, what I really like here is a drummer who's totally embraced something which will put him out of a job. It's like HMV embracing Amazon. What he said is, oh, these drum machines are here. And instead of going, well, we're not going to have one of them because that puts me out of a job, he just totally goes for it.
And without being a massive bore on the subject, the drum programming on this record really is something quite special, isn't
it? Yes, I think you're fine.
But Round and Round, the great neglected track, is just sounds so incredible. And the sort of the fills that are programmed in that no human could play are programmed with a drummer's real sense. It's not just often on electronic records you see people pressing buttons at random to get a pattern that sounds you would need, you know, eight legs and eight arms to play it. But this is kind of impossible for a human to play and yet driven by the sense of what a drummer would play if they could.
Yeah, so what they're working probably, I think, and I'm not quite sure, but there's a 909, which is a Roland drum machine. And that's done on a 16, how it works, it's done on a 16 step thing. So you press 1, 5, 9, and that's one bar.
And you've
bar.
Got Carol Decker's pin.
And then yes. What he will have done, he'll have you program in the drums all throughout the song on these little lights. You press them down, and that's how it was a real pain to do, but it's fantastic. Mm. Put a big load of shuffle on it, so it's got like a human feel. It's amazing.
I think there's a massive showcase for the 909 at the start of Vanishing Point, which is just that massive doof doof doof, which doesn't really appear much else on the record. Mm. Sean, this is the one that produced the infamous Smash Hits feature. When New Order go on tour and everybody ends up getting divorced as a result of the reportage in Smash Hits magazine.
I was at college when this record came out and I bought it on vinyl. And I think I read that piece, which is by a friend of mine. It got her into an enormous amount of trouble. Because there were women coming in and out of Barney's hotel room. And funnily enough, he thought that no one would notice. So anyway, blah, 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 blah. But I agree that it's a record. It shouldn't work on paper at all, should it? Because you've got Monk moaning about my girlfriend, you know, all that over the top of this incredible sequencing that is trying to sound as inhuman as possible. And then you've got warring bass as usual. You've got Hookie trying to get in there.
I'm still here.
And he said that he wanted to make a rock record. And they obviously don't want to make a rock record. And in that way that that tension within the band actually can produce something so unique sounding, although obviously there are bits that sound like The Cure.
In a good way, I'm not knocking it.
There's nothing else like it. There was nothing else like it at the time. It doesn't quite succeed in being Acid House. It just succeeds in being them. Mm. And there's something about those warring things. And I say that's kind of he's brought the rain with him, Barney, on this. But it works with this really high energy sort of background and really happy, happy pop, pop.
But that's that thing about the lyrics is really important. I mean, it's like the Mr. Disco that we just played is for all of the kind of multicolored, multi-layered, you know, electronic extravaganza. It's all, you know, it's like heart-rending. My life's falling apart, and it runs through the whole record. It's kind of a breakup album before the breakups happen properly.
Now you're dissing Fine Time, but I love Fine Time because Barney roars into it. He roars, "You're much too young," and you think, "Okay, this is bittersweet." That's an amazing song about that kind of push pull kind of what am I doing here.
I want to be clear,
you know,
I'm not dissing Fine Time.
Women coming in and out of hotel rooms.
I think Fine Time is fantastic, but I think it's bizarre in a way, and for a lead off single on your big moment album to do this thing that is a kind of cubist collage attempt to play Acid House on the machines you don't use to play Acid House with a big Barry White. You've got style. Oh, you've got class. Now I think this record has been quite ill served by posterity, because the versions that they put out a supposed collector's edition, and it was terrible. It was all like bits mastered off vinyl with pops and scratches and all the rest of it. Never been. I think this is neglected. I think we need a proper polish up of this, and there is supposedly a proper redo of Movement coming out later this year, which is for most people the least interesting New Order record, because it's when they were still a little bit Joy Division. This deserves a proper spit and polish, does it?
It does, really. You're right about Movement as well. And I think it is. I mean, they're only on the cover of Uncut. I'm pretty sure that it's just about rights and getting the whole thing together. It seems to me that now that Hookie is sort of involved, but begrudgingly involved, they can move things forward now. So, yeah, I think they should do it.
Factory are also terrible, or when they existed, were terrible for losing tapes and mislabeling things. If you look back at the New Order catalogue, it's a total mess. Same things come out with different titles. People forget what mixes which. It's all over the place. So I think it needs proper curation.
Totally agree.
By somebody.
What about big controversy? Why don't we just leave it as it is? Because I think if you remember in the 90s, in the days of the triple pack mix, 12 inches, which would pop through your door if you were a DJ or journalist.
Yeah.
New Order did suffer from quite a lot of bad remixes by people, and I just feel like it is of its time.
You want to know that when that happened, that was when they went to London, that was when Tongi was commissioning remixes hand over fist, and you'd get 6 different mixes of a not very exciting tune like 60 Miles an Hour with 8 minutes of drums at either end. And yes, you're right, we don't need that. But I think when you look at the Technique era, there's a bit by Steve Silk Hurley, there's a bit by Kevin Saunderson, because it's 1989 and that it's the law, you've got to have Kevin Saunderson. And that's kind of it. It's got a compact little body of work. I just think a bit of a sparky remaster, because what you've got now is probably the vinyl master sent down the years into streaming and so on, and not quite as punchy as it could be.
The other final thing on all of that stuff, and as someone who is way too much of a collector, a lot of this stuff just isn't on streaming services. It's why people who love physical formats will hold on to them for another 5-10 years, because if you want that remix of by Shep Pettibone, it's also true of the Pet Shop Boys. Some of those key remixes are not on streaming services, which means the only way to get them is either on the original CD single or what needs to be done now, which is a remaster. Like, I bet you the two mixes that you mentioned aren't on Spotify, for example.
They probably are.
Or Apple. I'm going to have a look.
Okay, fair enough.
So can I, another side point of order that I need to ask about. Is there a place online where one can buy, apart from the dance music retailers, where one can buy classic pop music in a WAV format?
Classic pop music?
Because I would go on the usual dance retailers and buy... the latest hip sounds, and they're all WAVs because you've got to do that if you're DJing.
Mm.
But it's harder to find, let's say, a classic pop track at that. What do you?
Well, the answer to that is broadly the answer is no. And again, it's another reason why people will keep CDs.
This is true. You can't download them on WAV. But what you can do is you can go down to Oxfam and buy all the Wham you could possibly need for a pound per copy of the final by Wham. So it actually all works out quite well in the long run. That's my suggestion. We're coming towards the end of the show, which means the return of closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a can of the Lager of La Motte as the Metropolitan Police Rave Suppression Unit clear them out of a warehouse in Hendon? Ralph Moore, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, it's got to be the Bohemian Rhapsody win. It's super fascinating. When Mixmag also had The Word next door, I very much bonded with Kate. He used to work there.
That's Kate Mossman, arts editor of The New Statesman now.
That's where I first met her. Mm-hmm. And we pretty much bonded over Queen, because I knew she was a big fan. Also, she did that incredible TV show where she finally got to meet Roger Taylor. It was wonderful, actually. And I'm not a super fan like she is, but I am very much interested in the way that that band have evolved and continue to make money. They're making more money now for that catalogue right now, regardless of the tours, than ever, ever before. So the thing for me is the film good, but it's how do they keep Bob Lefsetz did a post a couple of days ago saying this has raised them from a very, very good place to basically rock immortality.
This would be the industry commentator Bob Lefsetz, who sort of bridges insider and outsider.
Yeah.
I still haven't seen it. Is it worth seeing?
Well, I'm a purist with most pop things, so it is good, except for the fact that they jig around with the ending, and that annoyed me a bit. But, of course, they all recognise and acknowledge that, you know, the story didn't end with Live Aid, but that's sort of how the film ends. So that annoyed me a little bit. But it was a joyous experience, and, you know... There's a family who live below me, and Matthew's a writer, a sci-fi writer, very much like you, Andrew. Mm. He took his kids and took his wife, who works in the local library, and they all made a point of telling me, kids included, how much they loved it. So it kind of all of this chat about do you like this and do you like that, in the end, it's a smash because people love it.
Mm. Fair enough. Tony T, what's your closing time chatter?
I want to talk about the new Six Music schedule.
Oh, in what respect?
Well, they've changed it for the new year, haven't they?
Have they done?
Well, they put Lauren Laverne on in the morning and Marianne Hobbs after, and Sean Keaveney in the afternoon. And there was a little bit of a hoo-ha about it, but it's sliding in. So I've been with it for 3 days now.
Yeah,
I think it's working. I mean, it's very different because Keaveney was like the indie Steve Wright and very, very amusing.
Mm.
And Lon Laverne is, I would say, more muso. But she starts it very nicely, very gentle. It's a very gentle opening. And then the show gets livelier and livelier as the time goes on. And I think, and I've really enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it all. I've been listening to it all week. And it's been a great accompaniment. I mean, it's easy to have a go at Six Music. But I think it's a really vital service for, you know, probably the people who listen to this podcast, people like us.
It's funny to think that it was going to close down.
Yes.
They were going to close it.
Yes.
And it was David Cameron. It was part of the Conservative review with the BBC, wasn't it?
Yeah. And
where is he now, eh?
Yeah.
Where's Lauren Laverne? He's in his shed listening to Six Music while he writes a stupid book that nobody wants to read in his stupid caravan. There's justice for you.
I know. Anyway, I'm saying big up Six Music for having a try with something else. And I'm glad it exists. It's like BBC Four, isn't it? Not hugely popular, but you know, vital, like an encyclopedia. High fibre bread.
Hugely popular in our house. Anyway, Sean, what's your closing?
Oh, it's very simple. Kate Bush has said, "I'm actually not a Tory, and I'm relieved." You know, I mean, she's obviously has a right to be whatever she wants to be and believe in any political system going. But she's clarified her Theresa May statement that she made a couple of years ago when she someone did a bit of out of context and she said Theresa May was a wonderful thing. All she was saying was she was quite pleased that women were in power and it was part of a much longer conversation. That's all. It's just, thanks, Kate. I'm all right with you now.
Which is fair enough, except I was completely sort of browned off by the pathetic way in which it's like, oh, she's a Tory, now you've got to go and burn your copy of Wuthering Heights.
Yeah, that's absolutely what I'm saying. She can believe what she wants. It's fine. That's all right. Mm. But I'm just that little bit like, yeah, phew.
But I'm not so bothered about that as I am about the kind of people who have a fit over it. As if it's, you know, as if it's somehow the world is divided into good people and bad people, and you're
it's
either in the good people.
Of our world.
It is absolutely
polar. But it means Jerry Halliwell can now apologise for saying that Margaret Thatcher was really good in the 90s.
The difference is Jerry Halliwell is objectively dreadful, so that's the difference between her and Kate Bush. Yeah. Anyway, my closing time chatter, it's a bit of a sad one. It's David Kavanagh, the great writer for Select and Sounds, the writer of the incredible creation book My Magpie Eyes Are Hungry for the Prize, who passed away over Christmas, far too young. You don't get to work with many people who are properly kind of touched by genius, and he really was. He could write like nobody else. The first time I met him was in the old Select office in the now demolished Ludgate House on the down in Blackfriars, and he was literally sitting behind a wall of promotional cassettes that he had built. It was like the wall in Game of Thrones. It was around his computer, and he'd built a little kind of citadel for himself, and you know, quite a hard guy to get close to, and some weeks later actually knocked part of his wall down and he did his nut. But he was brilliant, and when I got to edit Select, we'd have let him write the whole magazine if we could, because he was that good, not just on REM and Big Star and what was then the Canon, but we managed to send him off to do things like EMF, thinking he's going to hate them and they're going to hate him, and they got on famously. Can't think why. They got on famously, and the copy was amazing. And it's just a real tragedy, because there should have been an awful lot more from him. He was not an easy guy to get close to, but he was an incredibly easy guy to read, and it's a real shame. So RIP David Kavanagh. And that's your show. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Ralph Moore and Anthony Teasdale. What pop things are you looking forward to this year? Peace and quiet.
What am I looking at? I'm absolutely in love with new dance music at the moment.
Okay.
Mostly, I know because I'm incredibly pretentious and world music about this, from South Africa.
South African dance music.
It's absolutely fantastic. There's lots of these like sort of like tribally type drums on it, and then beautiful pianos and strings. It's a great DJ called Black Coffee, and he's ace. And that music that makes me want to DJ in nightclubs. It's fab.
Fantastic. Ralph, how about you? What's your pop things you look forward to?
Well, the next cover of Mix Mag is Midland, who's an English producer who we've been trying to get on the cover for ages, and we've finally done it. And the cover's amazing. He's amazing. He's very, very lively on Twitter, but he's also the kind of DJ that can rock it playing, you know, world music at Love International or play a small club and play, you know, pure techno. So he's great. And then the cover after that is someone you'll know. It's Jeff Mills. We finally got a Jeff Mills cover. So, yeah.
So I mean, my dreams of Mix Mag becoming Rave Mojo are finally coming true.
Once a year, we will do a legend.
That's what we want.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ralph and Anthony. Thanks to Sean, as ever. And thanks to producer Alex Rees. Patreon backers, your extra bit will be with you soon, where we confess to the terrible genres of music that we can't help liking. We'll see you all next week. And we're going to play out with the most underrated New Order track from the Technique era, remixed from the album, actually. This is the Stephen Haig version of Round and Round, because Stephen Haig can fix everything. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.